Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan MacLeod. I'm very excited about our next interview. I'm on a Skype call to Pretoria to chat to Jim Adams, former deputy chief technologist at the US space agency NASA. Jim held the role from 2012 until his retirement in 2016. Prior to serving as NASA deputy chief technologist, Jim was deputy director of the Planetary Science Division in NASA's Science Mission Directorate, where he was responsible for the budget, scheduling, and performance of the agency's planetary missions. The Planetary Science Division is responsible for NASA solar system exploration efforts, including the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and the Mars Exploration Rover. During his career, Jim's work has included the design, development, testing, and operations of 24 launched spacecraft. Jim Adams, thank you so much for talking to Tech Central today.
No, it's my pleasure, Duncan.
Before we dive into some of the iconic projects that you've been involved in at NASA, please tell us a bit about what brings you to South Africa. I believe you are here to instill some excitement in school children about pursuing careers in science and technology.
Absolutely, yes. I retired from NASA after a long career in August of 2016. And since then, I've had the privilege of being able to literally travel the world to tell people about the wonders of space exploration and the benefits to society and that sort of thing. This happens to be my 15th trip to South Africa.
Wow.
And I'm here for a month this time around.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a number of different partners. One is SciFest Africa, which will be taking place. It's your national science festival.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be taking place in Grahamstown, Eastern Cape, next week. So I'm here to work with learners on an introduction to virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
Next week. And last week, I was in Johannesburg with the Square Kilometer Array, and they've got a partnership with the United States National Radio Astronomy Observatory. They're running a program called MAPP9, M-A-P-P-P-9, which is a training program for adults. So we're not talking about learners. We're talking about young professional science communicators. And it's a month-long program between these two organizations. And they invited me in to do some speaking and brainstorming with the team.
Great.
This week, I'm the guest of the U.S. Embassy, which is why I'm speaking to you. And so the U.S. Embassy has booked me into a number of schools, including township schools, to talk about space exploration and the importance of staying in school and studying math and science.
South Africa, Jim, is often derided for its education system, especially at school level in mathematics and the sciences, where, especially in maths, we often score worst in the world. How difficult is it going to be, in your view, for the country to get out of this mess it's in and start producing excellence in these subjects? What should be our priorities as a country?
So I think, to be perfectly honest, I think keeping on trying mm-hmm. is really important. Not giving up and not focusing on your rank in the world, but focusing on what the learners are doing once they've passed matric. I think it's extremely important to continue working with the learners, finding what works best for them, and then taking that to scale and using it across the country. You know, the United States doesn't rank very high in math and science either. We're 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have kind of similar sorts of problems, I think. I think it's important as we as a society move forward in a technological age that we have learners and a generation that's comfortable with technology.
Mm.
So my advice to learners is don't give up.
Right. And you obviously spend a lot of time talking to school kids about careers in the STEM, so-called STEM fields. Talking to South African kids, what sort of excitement are you seeing amongst them for careers in this field?
Well, I'll tell you what I see is I see hope.
Mm-hmm.
I see kids that, you know, they're very excited about NASA. And, of course, the likelihood that some of these kids will be able to work for NASA is kind of small. But, in fact, you know, the world of space exploration is changing, and it's becoming less the domain of governments, and now it's becoming the domain of commercial industry.
Mm.
And so someday there might actually be commercial astronauts and or citizen scientists that are working to further space exploration, or technicians working for companies like SpaceX. What I see from the learners is actually a vision of a future where space exploration and space exploration opportunity is expanding.
Right. Well, let me ask about that. Obviously, there is a huge interest in South Africa in Elon Musk. He grew up in the city that you're in right now, Pretoria. There seems to have been a real upsurge in private sector investment in space projects, and Elon has become a real poster child for that, if you like. Do you think that private endeavors will eclipse the work of NASA this century? And what role does NASA have to play in an era where private money is fueling investment in space projects?
Yeah. So you can imagine I get that question a lot.
Sure.
And so here, what I tell people is, number one, we are in an age of collaboration. We're not in an age of a space race anymore. And so what SpaceX does, or what the private sector chooses to do, that's something that NASA doesn't have to do.
Mm.
And so it enables each of us, each of our organizations, to focus on what we do best. And NASA will continue to push the edge, the boundary of space, exploring it not only with robots but also with human beings. And we will go to Mars and beyond together.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, the private sector and the public sector, as one nation, one globe, an international effort to continue to explore space.
Okay, so it's not a matter of the private sector versus governments fueling a new space race. Rather, you're saying that the private sector and governments and agencies like NASA need to work together to achieve these objectives.
Absolutely, and you know, like you say, NASA doesn't have to make a profit. So, what we have been doing since 2010 and earlier is trying to enable the private sector to take on the role that they are now. So the fruits of our efforts in partnership have they're starting to come to fruit.
Let's talk a bit about Jim Adams. Jim, you have a storied career at NASA. If you don't mind, tell us about a few of the highlights of your career and some of the projects that you've been involved in.
Oh my goodness, where to start? You know, I think the sweet spot of my career, as you mentioned, was the Deputy Chief Technologist for Planetary Science. Everybody's career, as they look back, they're going to have one spot that they think that was absolutely the best. And but growing up in NASA, I had so many fantastic opportunities. One that I think was just one of the highlights of my career was I helped to build a pair of satellites that we launched into orbit, not around the Earth, but around the Sun. And these two satellites had enough separation between them that when they looked at the Sun they could measure the sun in 3D, which was something that scientists had been waiting for a very long time, because they could not get accurate predictions of the impacts of solar flares and coronal mass ejections on the Earth's magnetic field. That's important to people on Earth because it tends to interrupt power distribution grids and geostationary satellites and communication systems. So we kind of made history with this mission called STEREO that I worked on. I think another, the iconic landing of the rover on Mars,
yeah.
That was fantastic. It was wonderful to be part of a team that did such an amazing thing. And then the one thing that doesn't get talked about too much, because it's a tad complicated, but we had a spacecraft called Stardust that we flew through the tail of a comet. We opened up a sample collection container and captured some of the debris from the comet's tail, brought it back to Earth, and the scientists that analyzed it found amino acids in the tail of a comet. So the building blocks of human life were found in the tail of a comet. And, at first we didn't believe them. We had them go back and check and maybe redo their protocols to assure they hadn't contaminated the sample. And no, in fact, we found amino acids in the tail of a comet. And comets come from a place in our solar system where no human being, not even Voyager, after all its years of traveling, has gone into this region of space. So it's likely, when you put all that together, it's likely that there might be life thriving beyond Earth even. And so that just really excited me about the idea of continuing space exploration and finding out what's out there and beginning to really kind of help humanity understand our place in the universe.
Is it not theorized, in fact, that life on Earth may have, in fact, started from the dust of comets?
Yes, that's true. We might have been seeded by another source. Then you have to ask yourself, well, where did that other source come from? And that's where it becomes conjecture and theory. But
sure.
But the bottom line is it is possible
yeah.
that just like much of our water might have come from comets, it's possible that at least the amino acids came
yeah.
from comets.
Do you believe, Jim, that the universe is teeming with life?
I believe that it's a possibility. If you look at just the probabilities, you know. Back in the early 90s, we thought, we were pretty sure there were planets around other stars, but we'd never seen one. And now today, there's over 1,500 identified planets around other stars. And that's, in our galaxy. And then you look, we're one of a billion stars in our galaxy, and there are billions of galaxies. Just the probability that life might have started beyond Earth, I think it's pretty high.
Pretty high,
yeah. The probability that we'll ever find it is, I think, pretty low.
Is that because of the vast distances involved here?
Absolutely. The huge numbers and the huge size of space makes it hard to fathom that we could accidentally run into it.
Yeah.
The other thing, within our own solar system, would we find humanoid life or intelligent life? I really doubt it. I think if we find life beyond Earth, it'll be single cell organisms or algae or microbes of some sort. But I think in my mind, that's still very telling about how life may have started on Earth. It's a clue to the source of life.
Yeah, even if we find, even if the only alien life we find on Mars or wherever it happens to be is microbial, for example, it would still be a very significant discovery.
I think that's exactly right. I think it will change the way scientists and philosophers and theologians look at everything about Earth.
One thing that's always intrigued me, Jim, is if the universe is teeming with life, why can't we hear it? Why are there no radio transmissions?
That's a really good question. You know, I have a partnership with the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute in California, and they've been listening for decades, and they're still not finding anything. I think a lot of it has to do with whatever might be sending us radio emissions is very far away, and if it's coded, we may not really be decoding it correctly, and the universe is still extremely vast. But, you know, your own square kilometer array here in South Africa, they've got a partnership with the SETI Institute to continue that kind of search in radio astronomy to help and scratch that itch to find out if maybe there might be other life forms out there making radio waves that we can begin to try and understand.
Well, let's talk briefly about the SKA. Obviously, it's a very big project for South Africa and Australia as well. How significant is the SKA in the field of astronomy and astrophysics? How important is it to some of the discoveries that scientists are hoping to make in the coming years?
So the Square Kilometer Array South Africa, which, as you pointed out, has its sister in Australia, and by the way, is now called SARAO, the South African Radio Astronomy Observatory, is probably going to be the most powerful radio telescope in the world. It involves eight different nations and radio telescope dishes spread across the continent, many of them clustered in the Northern Cape, but if you can get some of them spread further out, you get even better spatial resolution on the images that you'll be taking. It's going to change everything about astrophysics because it's going to be able to see further back in time than any other telescope that's ever been built. And so we'll get as close to the Big Bang as we possibly can with the Square Kilometer Array. But I think, you know, the other thing I have to do is applaud the government of South Africa for the vision of wanting to do this at all. You know, this is a huge project. There's 3,000 of these dish antennas that will have to be put into place. And along the way, what's going to happen is there'll be technological challenges, problems to be solved. And that will generate ideas and solutions that can be taken by entrepreneurs and creative people and used in ways that we never even imagined to make life better, life better for people that have nothing to do with a Square Kilometer Array at all. Plus, you know, the obvious about the jobs and infrastructure changes and that sort of thing. I think it's a strategic win for South Africa to have invested in the Square Kilometer Array. And I should say, just point out that next month, the central core of the SKA, called Meerkat, will be declared finished. 64 of the dish antennas, the first 64, will be made available to scientists to start taking data. And, you know, when they just had 16 of them operational, they pointed them towards an area of sky where radio astronomers had only ever seen about 70 galaxies previously. And with those 16, they were able to resolve 1,300 galaxies. So it's like putting on a new pair of spectacles for radio astronomers. It's going to be a fantastic opportunity, both scientifically and socially.
Fantastic. Jim, let's talk about Mars. Several organizations are actively talking about putting humans on Mars, Elon Musk, of course, among them. How feasible do you think this is, especially with the time frames that are being talked about?
So one of my big jobs when I was the deputy chief technologist at NASA was to work on the technology strategy for sending humans to Mars in the 2030s. And the bottom line is we have the technology to get them there,
mm-hmm.
but we don't know that we have the technology to keep them alive there or to bring them back.
Right.
And so one step at a time, you know, the next big thing on Mars with regard to humans is to try and figure out how to utilize the resources that are there on the surface to make life easier for the astronauts that will have to stay there for 18 months or so.
Yes.
So, and then after that, then we'll have to figure out how to build a rocket on the surface of Mars so that the astronauts can take off and come home. I think the feasibility is very high. I think it's a thing that NASA, along with partner nations around the world, could easily accomplish if they decided they really wanted to do it.
Mm.
And so that's where vision leaders like Elon Musk come in. And he says, you know, I don't really care what the nations of the world think. This is where my company is going. And, you know, every decision that entrepreneur makes is driven by his vision of sending human beings to Mars. And I think that's a fantastic thing. It's going to be great for NASA. It's going to be great for SpaceX. It's going to be great for everybody around the world.
What are the challenges involved in making Mars habitable for humans? I presume you'd have to build some sort of base on the planet, but what are some of the big key challenges that have to be overcome for the first human colony?
So the first thing that's the biggest challenge is getting the equipment to the surface of Mars in one piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we landed the rover on Mars, and that was one ton.
Mm.
It's estimated that for the first crew that goes to Mars, we will need to land 40 tons of equipment. And that includes rovers, and it includes, like, domiciles and laboratories and that sort of thing, because we will not be able to step outdoors in a shirt-sleeve environment and walk around the surface of Mars. And it's going to be very much like Matt Damon in The Martian.
Right.
And so but I think the first thing is figuring out how to get all that stuff on the surface of Mars and assembled properly with robots, in fact, before the astronauts ever arrive.
Okay.
And then working on and living on the surface of Mars, in my mind, it becomes almost the same as living on board the International Space Station, but instead of doing it in 6-month stints, these astronauts will be working in 3-year stints. And so, you know, they'll have to learn how to grow food, and they'll have to learn how to collaborate and socialize for 3 years in tight quarters. They'll want to go and do sorties and, you know, extravehicular sorties and that sort of thing. So how do you do exploration on the surface of another planet? The last time we did that was in the early 1970s on the surface of the moon. So it's going to be a new sort of thing, learning how to explore a new planet. I think that's the next challenge. And then I've already alluded to what I think is the biggest challenge is how do you get off the surface once it's time to come home?
Mm.
And building a rocket on Earth is hard enough, but building a rocket on another planet is even harder. So we'll have to figure out how to do that.
Will those first astronauts who go to Mars, I mean, does it make sense to bring them back? I mean, I'm sure there'd be volunteers who are willing to go there and die there.
Have you talked to Adriana Murray?
Yeah, indeed. We did a podcast
she's a South
with her.
African.
We did a podcast with her last year, and she's very keen to go and never come back.
That's exactly right. I've had the opportunity to be interviewed with her, and we were on stage in Johannesburg together. And while we don't necessarily see eye to eye on the return thing, I respect their her and the Mars One ideology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, NASA was set up by or challenged by President Kennedy to send a human being to the surface of the moon and return them safely.
Yes.
And that's been part of our culture since the early 60s. The Mars One initiative, where they say, we're going to send people on a one-way trip. It's not a one-way trip to die, but it's a one-way trip to thrive.
Yes.
It's a one-way trip to establish a foothold of humanity somewhere else. I think that's a remarkably different perspective. And I think to the extent that NASA can, we'll help them. So,
Jim, there's talk about sending humans back to the moon. Should we be going back to the moon? Is there any point?
So now you're asking Jim for his personal opinion.
Sure.
I'll just be really clear. You know, we were headed to the moon in a project called the Constellation about 10 years ago. And the last president came on board and he said, no, we're going to go to Mars. Let's not go to the moon. Let's go to Mars. So we were going to bypass the moon. And most of our plans were developed such that if the new president came on board and said, oh, no, I'd really rather go to the moon, we could just sort of re-vector things. And
right.
So that's what NASA's been doing. Should we go to the moon? Should we go to Mars? That's really a decision that's made by the president of the United States. But from Jim Adams' personal perspective, I think to go and build a space station around the moon as a departure point is a really smart idea.
Okay.
Whether or not we go to the surface of the moon from that departure point is really kind of up to politics and commerce and a few other things. But to put a space station in orbit around the moon and use that as a starting point for the journey to Mars, I think that's really smart. I can also envision NASA using that as a departure point for Mars, but also commercial industry coming alongside NASA and saying, well, we don't want to go all the way to Mars, but we would like to stop at your space station and use it as a waypoint on our way to the surface of the moon, because they'll be going to pick up minerals, or they'll be taking space tourists down, or any number of variety of things. And so I think that if the United States and the nations of the world were to put in a space station around the moon, it becomes kind of like an anchor tenant for deep space exploration and commerce.
Jim, I know we're just about out of time, but before we wrap up, a final question, and I know we've spoken about the SKA already, but what are you personally most excited about in the field? What projects in the coming years have really captured your imagination?
So if we're talking about the SKA, we've already talked about that. I think, and we've talked about Mars, that obviously gets me excited. but I think one of the things, you know, we talked a little bit about finding life beyond Earth.
Yeah.
And one of the destinations in our solar system that we'd have to go to with robots is called Europa.
Mm-hmm.
Europa is a moon of Jupiter. It's bathed in a radiation field that's so intense that human beings cannot stand to be there for 24 hours or 48 hours. It's got an ice shell that's a couple of kilometers thick. And underneath that ice shell, there's an ocean of liquid water that is 2 times more water inside it than the Earth has on it.
Wow.
And so, you know, wherever we go on Earth and there's water, we find at least microbial life. So for me, chasing life beyond Earth, Europa is like the prime destination to go. But how would we explore this ocean through a kilometer thick ice shell? Instead of a rover, we're talking about a submarine.
Oh, yeah.
So exploring an alien world with a submarine. I mean, it just doesn't get much more science fiction than that.
Sounds wonderful. So, sounds absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So that's one of the big projects that excites me, that I'm hopeful will not fall on the cutting room floor as we realize just how much it's going to take to get to the moon and Mars. But, so Europa would be like number three. So,
Jim, I have really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central today. Jim Adams is former deputy chief technologist at NASA. Enjoy your time in South Africa.
Thank you very much.